Well, good evening, everyone. Apologies for the slight delay in starting. In fact, it was our fault. We just got into conversation and then suddenly oh my God, is that the time? And especially as, unfortunately, it's going to be a slightly shorter talk this evening because Nicole has got to, I believe, get back up north. And so we will be slightly short today. So with no further ado, I'll briefly introduce our speaker this evening, who is Dr. Nicole Lindstrom. She's a lecturer in politics at the University of York. Her research examines the politics of Europeanisation and post-socialist states, with a particular focus on the former Yugoslavia and the Baltics. Her presentation at LISI is based on the findings of her forthcoming book, Europeanisation and Post-Socialist Transformations. And the title of her talk this evening is The Politics of Europeanisation and Economic Nationalisms in Estonia and Slovenia. Nicole, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me and thanks for coming out. So the book is out. The chair of my department just saw it the other day and he said, oh, that looks like a book of poetry. And I can say it's definitely not poetry, but it's concise, let's say. So the talk today will be some of the main findings from that book, as well as a piece that's coming out in the European Journal of Sociology. And what I'd like to focus on today in particular is the crisis and the impact of crisis on these two different models. I've pitched the talk, so there's a lot of political economy. I should say first that I'm putting Slovenia and Southeastern Europe very firmly, so and I'd be happy to discuss, you'll see in the talk that there's an element of how that in Slovenia is understood, whether they're in the Balkans or not. So this will come in during the talk. Clearly the Baltics aren't, but I think it provides a nice point of comparison. This also will be in the context of the EU and the crisis in the Eurozone. So please bear with me with some of the EU discussion too. So the question that I'd like to address today is if the Europeanization of post-socialist Europe has resulted post-accession to a diversity of welfare capitalist models, then the question I'd like to address today then is to what extent has this diversity persisted throughout the financial and fiscal crises that hit both of the case studies that I'll examine today very hard. So the talk will go over the diversity of post-socialist welfare capitalisms in this literature, the effects of Europeanization. Then I'll highlight the most different cases or trace a bit why these states are so different. And then the second part of the talk will look at the domestic politics of crisis in these states. And then I'll conclude by reflecting on what these domestic crises might mean or how this interacts with the larger crisis currently with Greece going on in the Eurozone. That will also, just to preview to the conclusions, whether Slovenia is in the South or Southeastern Europe, I would say that the crisis has put it back there. I'll conclude with that. Okay, so just the kind of general literature, the kind of debate that the book engages with, a kind of general observation. And when we talk about post-socialist development paths, and here we can go back to the transition literature, much of the transition literature in politics focused on domestic factors. And of course, these factors, there's a very long list. But in the political economy literature in particular, we could say there were three main thrusts: the kind of path dependency or communist legacy. Stark and Bruce and others talked about the extraction from communism and the legacy of different experiences under communism. Valerie Bunce and others have focused primarily on the first elections, the founding elections of the first successor regimes, whether this entailed an overthrow of the previous regime or more of a continuity. And then, of course, authors like Hellman and others talk about or focus on patterns of electoral competition. So here, the argument that in states where there was the kind of normal the normal pattern of a liberal regime followed by a more, let's say, gradualist one, to use the transition literature, and then Hellman's argument that what we really needed to be concerned about was not the losers of liberalization or economic transition, but the winners who took it all. And this, of course, could continue with many factors, but the observation here is that much of this early transition literature neglected transnational factors. So in the three factors I've gone over here, international or transnational actors were very much absent from this analysis. And on the reverse side, when we look at another, and I should say, just as a caveat, that of course there are many, many important exceptions to this. I would say Brockman's work in sociology about the transnational linkages under communism and after communism, so many exceptions to this, but I would say that was the dominant trend. And then the second kind of thrust were those that focused primarily on external factors. So in the early stages of transition, the so-called Washington Consensus and the impact of the IMF and other external factors, and then as these countries entered EU accession negotiations, then a focus on EU conditionality, which I'll return to in a minute. But the conclusion here was that the combination of factors led to an increasing divergence amongst the 27 post-socialist states, but convergence amongst new EU member states towards a democratic free market and indeed European states. So here, the divide between former Soviet states and the Visegrad states were clear. So in the kind of general scope of where my book is located in this debate, that I think that whereas the domestic, those that focused on domestic factors erred in failing to take into account transnational factors, I'd say that the turn to focusing on external actors, namely the EU, neglected to consider the diverse national context in which this conditionality played out. So this is where my book is situated. Okay, so I'd like to the varieties of post-socialist capitalist literature is an attempt to try to then further untangle the diversity of capitalisms that we can see within the new EU member states. And here, the argument or the kind of pertinent question is, can we see a diversity of welfare capitalist models in new member states, the same kind of diversity as we can see in the EU 15 or the original? And here, the comparative capitalisms literature, that an attempt by German authors to say that that there are a variety of models in the coordinated market economy, Germany being a quintessential example, can coexist with liberal market economies such as the UK and the US. And then in the Southern Europe, the kind of mixed market economies that have elements of both. So in the recent decade, many comparative political economists have tried to apply this comparative capitalist framework to the new EU member states and further east. And one of the main conclusions of this literature is that they're mostly mixed. So similar to the kind of observations about Southern European states, you have elements of liberal market economies and, let's say, collective bargaining arrangements and training, but then you'd have elements of a coordinated market economy in other ways, such as industrial policy. And here, very much, it was a kind of tick-box approach. In what way are particular states liberal, in which way are they coordinated? Nolke and Wiegelhardt in 2009 then put forth an argument that instead of applying these types derived from the West European experience, what all of these states have in common is that they're dependent market economies. And here, the analytical kind of argument is that instead of this tick box approach that shows that they're mixed, the main point of the comparative capitalism's literature is the complementarities amongst the five different factors. And in this analysis in world politics, they showed that that in this sense, a dependent market economy, that in all the areas of industrial policy, collective bargaining, training, and social cohesion, that it all was oriented towards making these states very profitable for basically foreign capital. So where I, Bulle and Greshkowitz, my former colleagues at CU, have then entered this debate by arguing that we can talk about varieties of post-socialist welfare capitalisms, that they're dependent, so very much tied to transnational capital, but this dependence varies. So yet again, an attempt to kind of break down this idea that all in the Minolke article, it's all Visegrad states. Bulle and Greshkowitz break this down even further. And using Polanyi, they argue that you need to look at the different relationships between market liberalization on one hand and then the counter movement to try to protect societies from this market opening and try to provide more social cohesion, and this is shaped by different national institutions. So the three varieties here are neoliberal, which corresponds to liberal market economy. Here the Baltics are ideal types, embedded neoliberal, and here the Visegrad states would be considered embedded according to their account. And then Slovenia alone in the third category, which is neo-corporatist, an attempt to maintain social cohesion in the face of liberalization. Okay, so in terms of, and then, so if that's the politics of transformation, what's the politics then of Europeanization? And here the conditionality and convergence literature, the main thrust here through Vakudova and Schimmelfeding and Sedlmeyer is that the EU, once these states were engaged in formal EU accession negotiations, this led all states on a liberal path. So going back to the kind of transition literature, if states were on a liberal path, so Bulgaria, Slovakia, that once they entered EU accession negotiations, these conditions forced these states to then follow a liberal path. And here her book, Europe Undivided, itself suggests that that they were going to be free market liberal states once entering the EU. And Schimmelfeding and Sedlmeyer similarly, but focusing on EU conditionality in particular, then conclude that we can see a high rate of compliance with EU rules and norms. So my argument in here, where I see that there's an absence in following Peter Mayer and others in kind of critiquing the Europeanization literature, is that politics is often absent in these accounts. So it's a top-down kind of mechanical model. The EU has a condition these states follow, and the attempt that it's a kind of institutional wasteland in which these states are more than eager to adopt the full range of EU legislation and EU rules. But then, building on this national welfare capitalism observations, I'd argue that these national welfare capitalist models shape domestic responses to EU pressures. So in neoliberal states like the Balkans, or the Baltics, the EU then is portrayed and perceived as an interventionist threat to their models. So indeed, in cases in the Baltics, that they exceeded the EU in liberalization. So when they were entering WTO negotiations, for example, the WTO said you actually have to impose more barriers to trade to be ready to enter the EU. So they far exceeded, and here trade was in particular very contentious in these states. On the other hand, the neo-corporatist or more embedded neoliberal models, the EU here is portrayed and criticized as a liberalizing threat, so a threat to that kind of social cohesion, that kind of protection of national industries, etc. And so the conclusion here, or in the next slide, but this depends on two important factors. The first is the degree of internal coherence and consensus around these models. So on the one hand, you need some kind of continuity in regimes and elites, but more importantly to my analysis is that you need a kind of normative consistency or an idea that these kind of models are somehow fundamental to the nation. It also depends on the degree of external coherence and consensus. And so, indeed, leading up to these states entering the EU, I would say that here the EU has elements of both kind of liberalizing or neoliberal models, but also a commitment to social cohesion. So in the sense, when we talk about, and we could debate this after my talk, but we could say that at least the ideal of the EU was somehow to embed, some scholars have actually called the EU an embedded neoliberal regime, an attempt to create a single market based on liberal principles, but then have some kind of social protection. And if we accept that the EU had a mixture of these two, then we can then see that states then, the Baltics, could then point to the kind of social cohesion goals of the EU or protectionist goals of the EU as a threat, and vice versa. Okay, so if we look at Estonia and Slovenia in particular, they've been cited, as I've mentioned, as the most different cases in the varieties of capitalist literature. And these differences endured leading up to and following accession to the EU. So in my book, I won't talk about it in length today, I show that they did indeed contest many of the EU conditions that they saw as posing the greatest threats to their models. In Slovenia, privatization, when the EU strongly urged them to privatize many of their state-owned industries. This met with resistance. Indeed, Slovenia entered the EU in 2004 with most of their banking sector in state hands. In Estonia, many of the social goals were also rejected. What explains the origins and continuities of these very different paths? Well, very briefly, starting conditions mattered. So, of course, Slovenians inherited a very favorable legacy from the former Yugoslavia with very competitive industries. Again, their history in Yugoslavia made, they had well-established export markets already, and they also, thanks to some very skilled bargaining, managed to take a small chunk of the Yugoslav debt. And a PhD student of mine has written a history of that, and the Slovenes were very masterful about making sure that that their debt burden was very low. Contrast that with Estonia, where the starting conditions, one could say they had no choice but to liberalize, given that their economy was completely tied to the Soviet Union. So starting conditions mattered, but I'd argue that it doesn't explain, so it can explain why they embarked on this path, but it doesn't explain why they continued on this path. Why, from independence to 2004, why was there no kind of real challenge to these paths? One would expect that even if they started, that we would see the kind of fluctuation that we saw in other states. And here my argument is that the architects of transition, and by these I mean not only political elites, but the intellectual elites and others, managed very skillfully to tie these capitalist models to national identity to achieve high levels of consensus and continuity. In other words, they made the kind of economic models somehow constituent of national identities. And this depended on several factors. One was that they very much saw themselves modeling the diverse capitalisms in Western Europe. So in the Baltics, this country was an inspiration of how to exist in the EU and how to develop. In Slovenia, they looked to the Scandinavian welfare states and Austria with its corporatist model as a model to follow. It also very crucially depended on another factor, which was that they were externally recognized as being success stories, but this was according to very different criteria. And this gets back to my point about the EU being a kind of embedded neoliberal regime. If you look at the Lisbon agenda, they used to put out, I don't think maybe they still do, but they put out a kind of scorecard. This is the naming, shaming, and faming kind of instrument of the EU to say, okay, which states are most competitive. And on the eve of EU enlargement in 2004, the two most competitive states, new member states on this list, Estonia came first, Slovenia came second. But then if you looked at the seven indicators that they use to rank these states, Estonia came out on all the liberalizing criteria, very high but low on the social cohesion indicators, and Slovenia vice versa. So this suggests, and in both cases, though, both states, the kind of Slovenian way or Slovenian model in the Balkans became a kind of model to follow, and there was the sense that it was a successful kind of alternative path to the neoliberal model. Estonia, very much, I think the Freedom House had ranked it, or no, the Wall Street Journal had ranked it the fourth freest country in the world in 2004. Slovenia was ranked on that particular list down, I think, at 46, down with economically uncompetitive states. But Slovenia, or Estonia very much, then portrayed itself as the kind of Nordic, one was the Nordic Singapore, which one would say was a kind of contradiction in terms. My Nordic friends always cringe when I hear this, but this idea that Estonia then was a kind of Baltic tiger or one of the leading success stories. So here then the analysis, we could say, follows a two-step discursive institutionalist approach, to put it in Schmidt's term. One, how these national welfare capitalist models were constituted as constitutive of the nation. And second, how these national economic identities then gave rise to different responses to common external pressures. So this is the framework. Okay, so then how has the crisis, to return to the question, how has the crisis then affected these two most different models? Do we still see divergence? And I'll just give just two brief snapshots. If we look at real GDP growth, you can see that whereas Estonia recorded high levels of growth, much higher than the EU throughout this period, for a period right before the crisis, it had double-digit growth. Slovenia also above the EU average, but not to the extent of Estonia. And then you can see with the fall of Lehman Brothers and the global financial crisis, Estonia plunged. It was one of the hardest hit countries, second to Latvia in terms of growth. Slovenia also very hard hit. If we look then post-crisis, Estonia joined the Eurozone in 2011. We can see this led to a rebound in growth, but I'll get to this in a minute. One could say then that Estonia since then has seen a kind of incomplete recovery and still in some financial economic difficulty. Slovenia also facing quite a dip, but its current accounts in other ways are looking quite strong. And then the EU, of course, in a continued flatlining of growth. If we look at social exclusion indicators, this is Eurostat based on many indicators of their social goals under Europe 2020. These are a percentage of people deemed at risk of poverty or social exclusion over 18. Estonia here has much higher levels than the EU average, and consistent with the two most different types, Slovenia here in terms of social exclusion. I've used Eurozone countries here. Slovenia facing, but as you can see, social exclusion is going up in Slovenia as it is in Estonia and the Eurozone as a whole. So these just two snapshots illustrate in kind of an empirical way the difference between these two types. Okay, so what was the impact of crisis in Estonia? Very briefly, just a bit on this, I'll go back to this dip. So what caused this dramatic dip? Well, one of the questions about Estonia, or one of the kind of, for those who study the Baltics, is how did Estonia maintain this neoliberal model when social exclusion and the hardship was so high? So poverty, and even as early as the early 2000s, people talked about a kind of two Estonias, those in Tallinn who were benefiting from this openness, and the rest, particularly the industrial regions in the east and Russian speakers, falling further behind. So the question is, why was this kind of radical neoliberal model sustained without dissent? One argument to this, at least to explain it up to 2000, is that they disenfranchised a third of their population. So the Russian speakers were most hardest hit by them having to pass very difficult language laws, therefore not given the vote. I think that we have to then consider this is a crucial factor. But to the impact of the crisis, so the kind of rifts were already being seen before the crisis, whether this could be sustained. But one key element that helped Estonia stay on this path was cheap and plentiful credit from Swedish banks and Swedish subsidiaries who flooded into the Baltics with in the kind of global boom of credit, looking for markets, and the Baltics was a good bet. In contrast to Slovenia, Estonia's banking sector was entirely foreign-owned, and a majority of that ownership was in Swedish hands. So, in a sense, Estonians getting cheap mortgages, able to buy houses, with housing prices skyrocketing in most of the Baltic capitals, Estonians could feel richer than they were by the fact that they had properties that were skyrocketing. So enter the crisis. Swedish banks pulled that cap, the mortgages, many of them were unserviceable. By the end of 2008, the fall in housing prices, 23% in just 1 year. Industrial production dropped 34%, the biggest drop in the EU. And the increase in unemployment increased the official rate to 15%, but much higher. And what the reaction to Estonia to this immediate crisis, I'll just give a quote by the then finance minister. What happened in Estonia was not a financial crisis. It was a local bubble and its international impact. Well, that international impact in particular was the Swedish central bank, who was now facing much of its banking sector that had expanded into the Baltics, now facing very large private sector liabilities. It had gone to the European Central Bank. In the end, it didn't need that financing, but there was certainly fears that it would as the Baltics continued on this downward spiral. But interestingly, despite this huge drop, the Estonian government were committed to joining the euro as quickly as possible. They set the date of 2010-2011, and despite this crisis, they stuck with it. And very interestingly, the IMF at this point, who, if we talk about international actors, we'd expect that the IMF, we talk about the so-called troika, that they would be pushing for this austerity. But an interesting recent analysis showed that the IMF and the European Central Bank had very different or slightly different ideas of how to remedy this crisis. And here the IMF was actually pushing for these states to ease their deficit targets, to devalue their currency. So here we had IMF officials suggesting to the Baltic states that they should abandon the peg and prolong euro entry or delay euro entry. And they also argued that these states should consider more stimulus measures. So in here, very curious, we had the Baltics yet again, where the IMF was pushing them, along with many economists, to use counter-cyclical or stimulus measures. Yet all of this advice was rejected. They stayed on course. In terms of stimulus measures, the only source of funds were EU structural and cohesion funds. So they did take advantage of the small pot of EU money, but that was basically the limit to what the government spent to get out of crisis. Okay, so then the question is, why did Estonia stay on this neoliberal course? So going back to the social exclusion indicators, there was great hardship. This was the most dramatic drop in GDP, or the biggest crisis. So why did they stay on course? Well, one explanation is that because Estonia had such a consistent and coherent neoliberal ideology throughout since 1991, and despite some changes of governments, stayed on that course. As some authors would argue, it hollowed out the political and bureaucratic arena of both ideas and competencies. There were simply no kind of organic economists or idea makers in Estonia to push anything but that neoliberal orthodoxy. And in the early stages of transition, a lot of the government was filled with U.S.-trained economists who were brought in. I think the first finance minister was 28. So in this sense, they really did clear the place of the old regime, filled it with these kind of and many emigres with foreign degrees. But you can see in this picture that I posted, the opposition parties, trade unions, and other critics, these were quite beleaguered, but still there, saw the crisis as a window of opportunity to try to change course. And trade unions organized a demonstration of 1,000, but for Estonia, this was quite significant. They had never seen trade unions organize a rally anything bigger than a handful. The opposition parties, the center party in Estonia, is very much linked to the Russian-speaking minority. In one of the demonstrations right around the crisis or right after, the center party candidate went around Tallinn handing out firewood and potatoes, demonstrating the hardship. But the counter-protesters were bigger than the anti-government protests, and the placards there said mayor of Moscow. So this idea that in Estonia, any kind of protest was always associated, and this had to do with protests around the memorial for fallen Soviet soldiers in Tallinn. Any large protests were associated in general Estonian discourse as being linked to the kind of Russian minority and their interests. So even an attempt to try to make economic arguments, to make arguments about the hardships of this austerity course, that was immediately reframed as an interest of as a national identity, somehow Russian speakers versus Estonia. And so here, national identity and these kind of politics remain very salient, I'd say, and a big explanation for why this failure to change course. If we look at external factors, Estonia entered the euro with the best convergence criteria. They far exceeded the convergence criteria, so they're the model pupil. And here, many that were pushing austerity, here Greece was starting to seek bailouts. Here, Estonia was being praised yet again for a kind of model of fiscal responsibility that other states should follow. And in following a lot of the kind of debates in the media and blogs, there would always be Greeks in the comment section saying, you bloody Estonians, like trying to kind of chain or being used as a kind of weapon in our domestic debates. There were dissenting views. So Paul Krugman in his New York Times blog, Estonia doesn't get a lot of international media attention, but Krugman focused on it in a very short piece. He said, you know, that Estonia is being celebrated by these austerity advocates, but if you look at Estonia, it's not a model. He cited the kind of incomplete recovery as well as the failure to address many of these social problems. And immediately, the Estonian prime minister responded, and they had a kind of Twitter war where he said that Krugman and those like him were patronizing to the kind of responsible, democratically elected small European states. And actually, an Estonian composer now has turned this into an opera. So this Twitter war is now put into song. Okay, so then what was before we get to the crisis in Estonia, similarly to Estonia, I'll get back to the, So similar to Estonia, it took a hard dip. Here, Slovenia had a housing and construction boom, but it wasn't quite as big as Estonia's. The shrinking export markets, like all states, led to this drop in GDP. But the most significant point, I'd say the most significant impact of the crisis in Slovenia is that it exposed a big problem in its domestically owned or state-owned banking sector, and that's what Slovenians would call the tycoon loans. And here we get to the Balkans, in that the tycoon loans, again, in the period of the boom, as this cheap credit, the governor of the Ljubljanska Banka said that basically he had so much capital flowing in that he didn't know what to do with it. He was giving it away for free. He did give it away for free, and he gave it to large stakeholders in Slovenian-owned firms, so Mercator, Laško, these big Irska, other Slovenian brands. And what these loans did, it allowed them to take bigger ownership shares in these countries or in these companies, using them as collateral. It also used this capital to fund expansion into the former Yugoslav market. So we saw a big expansion into Bosnia, Serbia, etc. And this capital was flowing to kind of this export to the former Yugoslavia. When the credit dried up, these loans, many of them couldn't be paid, and this led not only to a crisis, a financial crisis, where the state then, unlike Estonia, where the Swedish central bank had to deal with these liabilities, in Slovenia, the Slovenian state was very much forced to take over these liabilities. But what it exposed was this years of this kind of revolving door between industry, banking, and the government, which led to this kind of bust. So the government response to the immediate crisis was to push through a series of reforms. So Slovenia was ruled by left-leaning coalitions, more or less unchanged until 2004. They entered the EU and a right-leaning government came in. It tried to put forth radical reform measures, and they failed. And I remember interviewing an economist, a Slovenian economist at the time, and he threw up his hands. I think he quit after 2 months, and he was back at the economics department, and he just said, "We're never going to push through reforms. This population is too socialist in mindset. It's going to take decades." So they had essentially been given up. The boom years, of course, sustained. Slovenia was having rates of growth and with its competitive industries. When the crisis hit, this was yet another opportunity to try to push through these reforms, so liberalize a more flexible labor market, pension reform, privatization, etc. But they were thwarted by popular referenda, protests. So Slovenians are very good at using referenda to defeat most of the government initiatives. That government failed. A new right-leaning government came in, tried even more radical measures. They failed. The protests in Estonia were larger in number. They also became very violent, where the state, in many cases, used force to suppress them. It wasn't only trade unions, students, and others, but there was a great deal of popular mobilization, and not only in Ljubljana, but in Maribor and other other cities. And so why then did they stay on the neo-corporatist path? Well, whereas if we contrast this with Estonia, where civil society here was very weak, in Slovenia, the strong trade unions and civil society used mass protests very effectively. And on the scale, trade unions, here you can see the neo-corporatist legacy, but the mass protests were also, I should say, very importantly, fueled by more radical elements that were linked to ATTAC and other European networks. And I think a second important factor is that the Slovenian banking crisis implicated all ruling elites. So in this sense, it was perceived as a problem of corrupt, nepotistic elites, but it wasn't framed in Slovenia, I would argue, as an indictment of the prevailing kind of societal consensus underlying Slovenia model as a whole. So it was get rid of these corrupt elites, but I would argue there wasn't a kind of, that it wasn't the Slovenian model itself that was at fault. And then if we look at this intersection between internal and external factors, that the Troika coming in, and in many, in one case, and this was about the recapitalization of banks by the state, there was a public referenda. They got enough signatures. It was clearly going to torpedo the bad bank proposal. And the Slovenian Supreme Court ruled the referenda was unconstitutional. And here, there was every indication that the IMF, the ECB, were very much putting pressure on the Slovenian state to get rid of, or at least to try to somehow overcome the referenda as a barrier. And so here, by the Slovenian government caving into this pressure, there was this resistance that to these external pressures. And I would say then that this intervention emboldened rather than somehow constrained or weakened the critics of the Slovenian model. And indeed, if we just look at party politics, the left-leaning or the center-left-leaning coalition fell and was replaced by an entirely newcomer to the Slovenian scene, a constitutional lawyer who had never held political office. And he started a party, the Miro Cerar Party, which is just named after him, an attempt to start fresh. And I'll end on this, or just for the last slide, you can see this is a union, this is a Slovenian manufacturing firm, and you can see a sign in one of the many demonstrations here for social Europe. And here I'll use that as a point then to conclude. So looking at putting these two cases in the context of larger debates now in the Eurozone, the question here is that if my story about these kind of the relationship between Europeanization and these two forms of capitalism was mostly an attempt to preserve a national model against the kind of supranational authority of the EU. So if that's the story, pre-accession. The question then is, once they become members, not only of the EU, but as a Eurozone, then is there a kind of, will there be a shift? In my other research, I've looked at some of the kind of EU-level debates, and what we see here is that the Estonians have been far more proactive in pushing for a liberalizing agenda in the EU. So I've looked at several cases, the liberalization of the service market, any of the big contentious issues, you have the Estonians very much siding with the UK and other liberal states to push for a liberalizing agenda, at the same time trying to undermine some of the more social initiatives. So in that sense, we can see Estonia moving, not only as a kind of preserving, a rearguard action, preserving their national interests, but a much more proactive push to push for what we could say then a neoliberal European model. And them being cited now as the kind of darlings of austerity certainly then emboldens them to kind of act in this way. And if I argued around the point of enlargement, if there was some kind of social Europe, neoliberal Europe, I wouldn't say a balance, but at least a commitment to somehow find mediate the kind of neoliberal with some model with some kind of social cohesion. One could put an arrow there. It doesn't need any more arrows, but you could say that it's moved to the especially post-crisis, and here the work of Blythe and others is kind of the dominance of austerity now. And of course, we see that following the crisis in Greece. And so in that sense, then, if Slovenia, even more this pressure on Slovenia then to adapt. So I'll just conclude on a question, which is, and that goes back to the last slide, the four of the social Europe. Will we see Slovenia engaged in a kind of, let's say, a more proactive attempt to not only kind of preserve the Slovenian model, but to join this kind of transnational movement for some kind of balance to this dominant austerity narrative? It's a big question mark. I think that's the next thing, or the kind of one of the next research projects. But I would say, so my conclusion here is not that optimistic. I would say that because Slovenia, and this is a debate as well about Greece and how the Greek reaction to the crisis, in Slovenia, if it was seen as a homegrown crisis in many ways, exposing the cronyism of the banking sector, this is an idea that it's a problem of corruption, of rooting out the kind of negative consequences of the Slovenian model, but trying still, I would say, is a dominant kind of rear guard action. So protecting Slovenia, but not, I would say, as of yet, a more proactive attempt to join forces with other alternatives. So I'll leave it there.
Nicole, thank you very much.
Way over time.
No, we've got actually about 20 minutes or so for questions. Who would like to kick off? Is that a taker? I see Bernard.
All good, clean, fun. As somebody who's done work in both of those and some of their neighbours at various times in the past, I was intrigued by, I hope, your rejection that there is a fifth world of welfare capitalism, because my belief is that all these things are sui generis in any case, and I kind of rather like that. One of the things which I was struck by is a profound difference between Slovenia and Estonia is that Estonia had 30-40% of its population who were Russian, who could be disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. I think that was extraordinarily important. That's the language I was thinking about. There's no equivalent to the Russians in Slovenia. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no equivalent. So a lot of things which you could perhaps do in Estonia you could not do. And I wonder whether you could comment a little bit about that, and whether in the same way you could comment about political parties and political constructions. I mean, because I am always intrigued by the way in which politics becomes highly personalised in these countries. Mm-hmm. You don't have parties, you have groupings around individuals, and these things come and go. Estonia being a classic example of this, where you can effect nothing there that was there 10 years ago and nothing there 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. A bit less so, I mean, and that's slightly more newer development in Slovenia, which I think is where something. I think the other thing which struck me is this this point about how Slovenia managed to have a very low level of debt. And because of that, it was terribly resistant and did not need to take notice of the international financial institutions mm-hmm. in a way that some of the Baltic and some of the other countries actually needed to. So therefore, there was nobody around kind of pushing them into particular practices. I know Tina will not forgive me if I mention pensions, but I do know that pensions are policy and pension reform in those countries and very different paths taken has quite a lot to do with that. she turned me out of backing up because she said Bernard always asks three questions and insists upon mentioning pensions.
I would be interested in hearing more about the pensions, so I think it is. Thank you. Yeah, I think those are excellent. And I think questions. And I think your point about that there is no other, no comparable other in Slovenia, in Estonia, I think that can explain a lot. In fact, I'd say that's one of the key factors. Not only the disenfranchisement of 30% of your population, but in a continual other. And of course, today, you could make a case that this Ukrainian crisis has only emboldened this idea that it's the state now has to protect itself even more about not only external threat, but the threat from within through the destabilizing. So, yes, very much, I think that this is a key goal. To just a brief point on that, there is the so-called erased in Slovenia. Mm-hmm. So those former Yugoslavs who were left or who lived in the borders, who were basically denied, erased. So it was a kind of bureaucratic, some call it bureaucratic ethnic cleanse, they were erased from the government roles. But this, it's smaller in numbers, quite significant, but smaller. And in terms of broader debates, it's very hard. I mean, certainly the right uses an anti-Yugoslav rhetoric, but it's very hard to have the same kind of rhetoric about anti-Yugoslavs. It has much more to do with World War II and long-standing rather than the kind of any threat from Belgrade or a kind of economic legacy, because, of course, Slovenia benefited quite a lot from that legacy, quite in contrast from Estonia. So thank you. And the low level of debt, precisely. The IMF did come to Ljubljana to press them, and Mensinger, the first finance minister, said to the prime minister, "You either listen to me, or if you listen to the IMF, I'm going." And the prime minister put his lot in with Mensinger. So so the IMF tried half-heartedly and failed. So. But yeah, the levels of debt, most precise. But I just stress that explains a lot of it, but not the continuity. So.
Sure.
Okay, so I have two questions. One is, because I don't work in this area, what happened with the other Baltic states? Were they in this group as well, or did they do their own thing? And then the other one is, especially your discussion of discourse in Estonia, can tell from our accents, is the U.S. not a beautiful example of this as well? And anyway, you might comment a bit on, yeah.
The Baltics, they definitely, if we wanted to kind of differentiate amongst them, Lithuania would be seen as probably closest to the embedded neoliberal, so with Latvia more in Estonia, so Estonia on one side, Lithuania on the other, with Latvia in between. Latvia also suffers from much higher rates of poverty and social exclusion, and the crisis has made that much worse. So, yes, there are differences in the Baltics, and that's why Estonia, being the kind of ideal type, it pursued the most neoliberal.
Insist that they are very different.
Yes, exactly.
They reject the notion.
Yeah, and interestingly, on identity, Estonia, in the kind of identity discourse, it does not want to be considered Baltic, and it very much wants to be seen as Nordic. So this parsing is that because of its language, the prime minister talked about Yule land, which I think is very interesting. Any country that uses the Yule log. And in that sense, he traces that the UK uses the Yule log, and it goes around Scandinavia and then to Estonia, but not the Baltic. So Yule land was his attempt to, I think, even tie the UK in with the Scandinavian and Nordic states. So in the Estonia sees itself, yeah, Lithuania is more Catholic and Central European, more Nordic. But of course, those attached to this Nordic social model sees this as a bizarre. I mean, it's not a reciprocal kind of relationship, because not many Nordics see Estonia, at least in political economic terms, as belonging to that kind of tradition. So there's a bit of a conflict between the cultural identity and the economic identity. And yeah, the discourse, are you referring to this kind of logic of no alternatives, or?
So any alternatives proposed in the US, brand you as a socialist or a communist. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if perhaps you might say a bit about that. It explains a lot. I'm just thinking that your model might travel quite far because of this way you can envision the discourse, but I'm not sure how you might respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting... So in the US, it's a, you're a socialist or communist, but that's a economic ideology or a partisan kind of an ideology. In Estonia, because of that Soviet legacy, it's even more powerful because you're a communist and a socialist in Russian, or a Russian mm-hmm. sympathizer. So it even packs a greater punch than in the US. There, you're marginalized as an ideologue or an ideological terms. In Estonia, you're marginalized as a threat to the nation. I mean, so it's, you think the US is bad, but I think Estonia pushes that even more in the sense it's very much wrapped up in whether you belong, to, if you're a threat, an internal threat to the nation. So, but yeah, it could
be. No social democrat parties, you can't have the term in your party label.
Exactly.
So you have to, this comes back to the big bang, groupings around individuals, but you don't call yourself that and you can't call yourself.
Yeah, so Edgar Salazar, who's the head of the Centre Party, he's not that skilled of a politician and he's not even that left. He's, I'd say, very centre. But he's repeatedly branded. I mean, that was Edgar for mayor of Moscow. So if he even made a case that the crisis in the Estonian model was leading to economic hardship, not a controversial point, it immediately was framed as he's a threat to the nation. He's acting on behalf of Moscow. So it's very powerful in marginalizing any dissent.
Could you say a bit more about this idea of Europeanization? It figures in your title, and there was one slide in which it appeared. But as somebody alongside James has done quite a bit of work on Europeanization, I didn't get a sense from your talk of how it fits into your model, or where it fits in, or what you mean by Europeanization.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that's quite... Yeah, it did drop out a bit of the talk. So in the Europeanization, especially the EU conditionality literature, the Europeanization traveling east, what I find lacking in a lot of that literature, this is not true, is that when we talk about the EU conditions, it's very much, a lot of it was kind of the acquis and chapter counting, so you take an EU, and a lot about compliance, and here's my attempt, and it's quite sloppy and incomplete, an attempt to kind of say, well, what's the social purpose of the EU beyond the series of legislation, which of course adds up to a purpose, but what are they trying to achieve here? And in that sense, then I'm engaging more in debates about what is the EU project, what is the kind of ideational basis, and then how did particular conditions try to push that and then resist it? But here I would say, yes, it's all a bit vague and fuzzy. I've worked in conditionality. I mean, in the book, I go into this much more, but when you look at, for example, EU pressure on Slovenia to privatize their banks, that falls out of the kind of, I mean, always in the kind of regular annual reports, they always said it would improve your competitiveness in meeting the Copenhagen goals strongly. And in a lot of my research on that case, you saw that the commission was there very much pushing for this liberalization. And those kind of very fundamental, I mean, this was one of the main conflicts between the EU and Slovenia. A lot of that would be missed if you were just focusing on the degree to which it complied with competition policy or single market. So it's an attempt to widen a bit beyond just the legal transposition and implementation.
Gentlemen, my name is Mariusz Krupniak. I'm from the Warsaw School of Economics, Poland. I'm also engaged in some projects about the models of capitalism. And I would like to ask you about your opinion. How many models of capitalism can we distinguish in the Central and Eastern European countries? Can we say that all the countries from Central and Eastern Europe belong to one model of capitalism, for example, post-communist capitalism, or each country has its own model of capitalism? Because in Western European countries, as you mentioned, we can distinguish Mediterranean model, coordinated model, liberal model. And because I'm from Poland, we carry out research about the models of capitalism in the Central and Eastern European countries. So I would like to listen about your opinion. So, how can we classify that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd go back to your point about that there's as many models of capitalism as there are states. So it's a sui generis. I mean, this attempt to create typologies, it's an exercise in...
Can I give you an example which I wrote about 14 or 15 years ago now. I described this exactly, I was confronted with exactly the situation which Nicole was faced with. And I described this as being like Rubik cubes. Now, with a Rubik cube, you're supposed to get all the colours on the one side and the colours on the other side. And what I was trying to do, I was looking at exactly the kind... I was looking at social policy. I was actually fairly constrained in what I was trying to do. But I sort of said, well, OK, do they match up on things like pension systems? So can we get sort of pensions or social protection in one cup? And I could possibly match a group of them up on having similar pension systems. But then when I looked at something like labour relations systems, that group didn't match up on labour relations. So although they were sort of all one colour there, they were different colours on a different side. And then I started looking at a number of dimensions of what I could call social policy, and looking at the colours. And every time, you know, you line them up on one, so I lined them up on labour relations systems, but then they didn't match on pension systems, or then they didn't match on something else. And I described this in the end, as I said, it's like trying to get your Rubik cube and line it up, and in the end, it never works, so you end up by taking a hammer and smashing the whole thing. And my view was that, you know, you couldn't do this. This was the limits of these sort of worlds of welfare capitalism. You could add a fourth world, a fifth world, a sixth world, but you still didn't get there. And this is why I said it's all silly generous.
Yeah, I mean, this Bolle and Greshkovich attempt that I've mentioned, the three ideal types, many have criticized them in that's what they're basically looking at is social welfare states, although they do have industrial... What I would say, to answer your question, I'm actually most sympathetic to the dependent market economy. I think they've oversimplified it, but they've made a case about the kind of complementarities in these states that are... It's a very persuasive argument in that they're... What unites them all is they try to make it attractive for capital, or it's all oriented towards supporting foreign direct investment. But as you say, it's a Rubik's Cube, because you can look at levels of foreign direct investment, you can look at vocational training models. There's great diversity. I'm teaching a course on this module on this, and I've had my students tasked with a presentation to do a lot of this, and I think what I'll find is they'll come up exactly what you describe as a great variety in these states. But
except it's terribly tiring that you sort of you go in and you teach this kind of thing, and these people drag out the S.B. Andersons of this world, or the Holes and Soskises of this world, and are convinced that everybody, I mean, it's serious people whom you sort of, you then find that they get to group people into three groups or four groups if we're very lucky. And we have an example from this and we have an example from that, and therefore this will show that this happens here and that happens there. And I find it extraordinarily tedious and unproductive.
Yeah, and it's generating PhD after, yeah.
Exactly. And if these things are not my desk, I check them out.
But if you, yeah, I could, we could have a much longer.
Can I have a comment on that as well? I think it's very important, you know, to look at the methodology and epistemology of how we think about these states. Yeah, like you were saying, you know, we can't just take one piece. And I really like... In terms of post-socialist Europe, I use literature, geography, and post-colonialism that basically looks, you know, at how the history of these states it has simply been erased, and all these kind of ideal Western types, yeah, like varieties of capitalism and so on, were pushed, yeah, and also the way how researchers were researching them and so on. So I find this literature very kind of inspiring in challenging, you know, the normative knowledge production. And it also shows the way, you know, how these political discourses are fought within Central and Eastern Europe. So, for instance, if you look at Slovenia, yeah, it's this division between socialism and a kind of, you know, let's say the protests. Zombies were branded as as socialist zombies, yeah. And it was kind of, you know, no, we have to go forward, we have to become, you know, the Europe and so on. So I think it's very much embedded and it's very much connected with, you know, kind of completely making socialist history completely obsolete.
Yeah.
And it's wrong, of course, you know, because the politics has to build from its history. Yeah,
yeah. I fully agree. And when you look at the history and Joanna Brockman's work and others, where they've brought that history back in, what I've described about Estonia being used as a neoclassical triumph, that was happening in the 60s and 70s, where neoclassical economists were coming behind the curtain to kind of explore these. It's not these linkages or the use of these external models, it's not new, and I think that's a crucial point. And here the sociologists and historians are probably doing far more than the kind of typologizing that maybe isn't getting us very far. So yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that.
What I like is the resurrection of the polyclinic. Interesting thing which one had in the German Democratic Republic when I used to live in the Federal Republic of Germany, which I lived in the West Berlin, and the polyclinic was a dreadful thing. They had polyclinics in certain politics. They had it in other places. And of course, the first thing that happened, sort of post the change, and, you know, kind of I was out there for the OECD, they were getting rid of polyclinics and as far as they could, dreadful things. Now, even the Germans have started resurrecting polyclinics, actually calling them polyclinics again, because they've actually discovered, you know, kind of delivering healthcare relatively locally in some integrated fashion was a damn sight better than the things they thought they ought to have if they were creating healthcare systems for market oriented economies.
But I could talk about that too. Another, Hugo nostalgia.
It is the heritage, you see, that, you know, you do throw some things out of the bathwater. I mean, in the eastern lands of Germany, I mean, there's quite a lot of handling. Okay, somebody's taking very dangerous forms, but it's quite a lot of hand wringing about some of the history which, you know, kind of we threw out and downgraded. And it expresses some very simple things, like, you know, sort of a desire for the old kind of cigarettes or the old kind of beer.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually tomatoes which are grown in people's back gardens as opposed to come out of supermarkets wrapped in plastic.
Yeah. Well, the Slovenian, I mean, Lasko, the entry into the Bosnia, former Yugoslav, is playing exactly on that nostalgia.
And getting into the EU and immediately getting Ivar and Chvapchichik supporting their own product.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I think we have to call time there, as Nicole's got a train to get. Before I thank her officially, I just want to make a couple of announcements about next talks. The next one is actual fact in this room tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, and we actually have Kosovo's Minister for European Integration, Bekim Cilaku, coming to speak on the subject of Kosovo's EU integration process after 7 years of independence, what's next? Obviously very, very topical given everything that we've seen happening in Kosovo the past few weeks. And then the last visiting speaker of this academic year is actual fact in 2 weeks' time on Tuesday, 10th of March, again, as ever in this room at 6 o'clock, and that's Anka Puska from Goldsmiths University of London. Right, now I have to get this straight. Understanding Roman nomadism today, the case of Romanian Roma. a beautiful tongue twister there for the final one.
And she is excellent, really.
Yeah, no, I think it should be. So it just leaves me to thank Nicole this evening for coming along and giving such an interesting talk. Bernard's a tough customer. He was really getting his teeth into it and enjoying it enormously.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
You've got one extremely satisfied customer there from the sounds of it, which is...
I'm going to get whacked by Taylor when I get back.
It's always a very, very good sign. But thank you very much indeed for coming this evening.
Thank you.